Hi, I'm Lori Jones, President and CEO of Avaset Communications and host of StrategyCast. Join me and my guests, innovators, disruptors, and visionaries as we explore bold and brave marketing strategies that help you transform, scale, and grow your brand. My guest today is Dale Harrison. Dale's journey from experimental physicist to a leader in marketing for Inforta Life Science Services is as compelling as it is instructive. In this episode, Dale will dissect the flaws in chasing marketing efficiency and ROI and advocates for the primacy of effectiveness in driving long-term business success. For Dale, marketing is all about creating lasting brand memories, and he reminds us why market research isn't just a buzzword, but a necessity. From the misadventures of tech giants to the subtleties of brand positioning, Dale's expertise offers a blueprint for growth-minded leaders. And don't forget to check out the most recent issue of the StrategyCast newsletter on strategycast.com. Just like this episode, it is full of inspiration and a ton of ideas that will elevate your strategies and marketing know-how.
A competitive edge starts with strategy, and strategy starts with knowing how to develop one. StrategyCast is a leading marketing podcast that serves up strategic insights, trends, and tips to help separate your business from the pack. Tune in weekly as host Lori Jones interviews bold marketing leaders who have priceless wisdom and are willing to share. Each episode explores cutting-edge approaches that have proven instrumental in transforming brands into industry trailblazers.
Welcome to StrategyCast. I am so excited to have Dale Harrison join the show today. Dale is just incredible when it comes to B2B tech and life sciences, bioscience, SaaS, all sorts of different marketing. He is with Inforta Life Science Services. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I tell you, I am so excited to dive into our topic today, which is all about marketing effectiveness versus marketing efficiency. Before we get there, tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey.
Well, it's a long story. So
it's only a 45-minute show.
Right. So I only came into marketing later in my career. So I did a lot of different things before I started doing marketing. So originally, I was an experimental physicist. So I did superconductivity research. So that was several careers ago. I ran a company for quite a number of years doing technology development, mostly robotics, automation, some AI stuff, and then fell into biotech kind of mid-career. And initially on the technology side, then I jumped to finance. So I did a long stint on the finance side and valuation analysis for M&As and restructuring and recapitalization for turnarounds.
Wow.
And then I ended up falling into marketing. So it's been an interesting journey, but what it also gives me is a lot of kind of unique perspectives and unique experiences from outside of marketing that I bring with me when I look at marketing problems.
Right. You know, I love the fact that you say you fell into marketing. What was that moment, that day, that opportunity like? And then how long ago was that? So basically, has your marketing career been a good 50% of it? Or is it something that you have spent 75% of your career doing?
Probably the last third,
yeah,
roughly. And so originally, I was running the technology group for a VC-backed startup. And this was in the earlier days of the internet. And we had a marketing team that was basically very old school. So the way I used to describe them was that if it didn't involve killing a tree, it wasn't marketing. So it was like everything was print, everything was paper. And the CEO was very frustrated trying to get them to move into digital. And our customer base was entirely already on the internet because we were selling to academics and universities. So I ended up standing up a digital marketing team inside the technology group. And so that was my sort of first introduction into kind of being in the trenches doing digital marketing campaigns. Mm-hmm. And so it was a very interesting experience.
But we were all learning digital at the same time. So your technical background, I'm sure, really helped
Oh, yeah.
Foster that curiosity for growth, really.
So, you know, and having a scientific background, it was a very kind of measurement analytics oriented approach that you could do with digital in a way that you really couldn't do it in the same way in the non-digital world.
Mm-hmm.
And so it opened the doors for a lot of approaches and a lot of techniques that in the years since then have become quite standard. I think at the time was probably more novel than I realized. A lot of the things we were doing. So for instance, we built an entire web analytics tracking system, and this was around 2000. So this was before Google Analytics existed. And we essentially built an equivalent of Google Analytics to do our own web tracking.
Yeah.
And we had no idea that there was that anything was special. We just assumed this is what everyone did who built a website.
Right. I tell you, that is impressive. I should have you back on the show to specifically talk about AI at some point. I can only imagine what you're doing with that. So one of the reasons why I was so interested in having you on the show today is you have an article, I teed it up just very briefly at the beginning of the show, titled Marketing Effectiveness versus Marketing Efficiency, that has absolutely blown up on LinkedIn. And it is one of those articles that really stopped me in my tracks. Number one, it's very interesting because I don't think people know which one of those areas they should really be taking a look at. So we're going to dive into that in just a minute. But it's had 548 likes, 99 comments, and 71 reposts. So you all can find Dale Harrison on LinkedIn as well to get more information on this article. But tee up the reason, why did you feel it was so important to get this idea across of what is the important thing to be talking about here, efficiency or effectiveness?
Well, and I think this is a good question. And it's something that I think has been lost in the last 20 years with the rise of digital, in that all of the tools that we've got, so all of the multi-touch attribution tools, of which there are now thousands, they are basically focused exclusively on questions of efficiency, mm-hmm. and as opposed to questions of effectiveness. And so efficiency is basically what's the cost for a given volume of actions, what's the rate of response for a given volume of actions. You know, so you look at things like cost per lead, CPM, click-through rates, conversion rates. These are all efficiency metrics.
Right.
And one of the big efficiency metrics is ROI, that you're not really looking at the effectiveness of the campaign. You're simply looking at your efficiency of burning budget.
Right.
And one of the things I think that has been lost, especially in kind of tech B2B marketing in the last 20 years, has been this idea of, is the thing we're doing effective or is it merely efficient?
Right.
And the problem with an exclusive focus on efficiency is that if what you're doing doesn't work or doesn't work well, just because you figured out how to do it at half the price doesn't make it a success. It's
exactly.
still a failure.
Yeah, exactly.
And so you have to establish effectiveness first before you can start to worry about efficiency. And I think one of the big examples of this, and I've got another post specifically on this, is around marketing ROI, that there's this sort of obsession with this as the gold standard number. And marketing ROI is a very, very flawed metric that, quite frankly, I don't think should even exist in marketing. One, you can't measure it. Or at least most marketing teams are incapable of measuring ROI. And the reason why is that there are significant lags between the marketing you do this period and the effects that will have on revenue downstream.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you look at really good marketing mix modeling studies, what you see is that your current period marketing will continue to have revenue effects out 2 to 5 quarters into the future. So there's a very, very long tail on what you're doing today in terms of impacting future revenue. Likewise, stuff you were doing 2 to 5 quarters in the past, so as much as a year and a half in the past, is affecting the revenue that's being generated this quarter. And so when you do an ROI calculation, how do you know which pieces of marketing cost from the past and which fraction of the current marketing cost do you apply to the I part of the equation,
right.
the investment part? And then what part of that revenue is then applied to the marketing efforts? And this is the other issue, is that only a portion of revenue is generated by marketing. That if you completely shut marketing down in a company, revenue will continue on. And there have actually been some very good academic studies just recently looking at companies that quit marketing. And what you see is revenue continues on without a substantial drop for up to 2 years, which means that there's a long, long tail. Now, eventually it will start to drop, but there's a long tail to the effects of marketing that you're doing right now that still last off into the future. And a lot of this is the fact that much of marketing, especially if you look at brand marketing, is really about implanting memory traces and recall triggers in people's minds. And those memory traces can last for a very long time. And much of your marketing effort is really this investment in memories. And those memories have a very long lifetime that continues on well after you've quit doing the marketing.
Right.
And so...
Let's break all this down a little bit because there's so many incredible nuggets there. And, you know, marketing, it can be looked at a sustaining force, but it can also be looked at as an introductory force as well. And really, I think the best marketing programs are where the two of those are combined. Without marketing and without a brand name, let's say you're a new entrant to the market. Obviously, without marketing, it's going to be very, very difficult to create the top of mind awareness that is needed to ultimately impact the sales and revenue goals that you might have in the market. So there's an entry, but then there's sustaining and maintenance point after that. Where do you feel the real crush regarding the sustainability can last as long as 2 years happens within the lifespan of a business?
Well, I mean, to back up for a second, if we think about a counterfactual of a company that never had a marketing department, mm-hmm. and there are a lot of these in the startup world. So a lot of the work I do are with early stage or growth stage venture-backed tech companies. And you see a lot of companies where their very first hire will be a salesperson, not a marketing person.
Right.
Yeah, and what they're looking for is they're looking for an experienced salesperson that has years of experience in this particular category, that has a good Rolodex, that has a good list of contacts. And that salesperson is going to be out there making phone calls and sending emails and reaching out to their contacts, and they're going to be making sales. So at some level, you can generate revenue growth over time with no marketing at all. And there are plenty of companies that show this.
Right.
The problem is, it's not a very effective way of doing it. And
marketing brings, you know, the cost of sale down.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the way to think about marketing is that marketing is a nonlinear driver of other linear functions within the business. Mm-hmm. So if I'm the CFO and I'm looking at the sales team and I've been told we need to double revenue next year and all I have is a sales team, I'm going to basically have to double the number of salespeople because right. I'm not going to be able to get that each salesperson to make twice as many calls or close twice as many deals. If I need twice as many deals, I need twice as many salespeople. So there's a very linear relationship between revenue production and the amount of resources you pour into sales. But if I go over to marketing, I can take a relatively few number of marketing staff and have them do campaigns that reach thousands or tens of thousands of people. And so now, with a much smaller investment, I have this kind of very nonlinear impact on revenue because I've now, not because marketing is generating revenue, marketing doesn't. Marketing, you know, sadly, in spite of all of the stuff people talk about, marketing is a cost center. Mm-hmm. But what it does is that it makes sales both more efficient and more effective. And it does so in very specific ways because one, especially in B2B, there's this notion of an initial consideration set. So when a company wants to buy a product, they're going to start with typically, and there's really good both Gardner and Bain & Company research on this. Companies will start with two or three brands that they already know about before they ever begin any market research. So by marketing being able to implant those brand memories in people's minds, you've now increased your probability of being in that initial consideration set. So about 85% of companies will start with what's called a day one consideration set. 90% of the final buying decision comes out of that day one consideration set, which means that if you're waiting until someone's already in market before you attempt to reach out to them, you've basically already lost the game.
Right.
And so, So the other thing that marketing does,
getting to that low-hanging fruit just is not as easy as it was, you know, years and years and years ago.
Right. But the other thing that marketing does is this idea of brand trust, because if someone knows and trusts the product, and some of this is from personal usage, some of this is from marketing, some of this is from word of mouth, but the more that you can establish brand trust before they come in market, the more there is a willingness to pay a premium for that product. And so marketing has this ability to directly impact pricing power. And the way that generally is, the way you see this translated is that the sales team have to offer discounts to fewer prospects in order to close the same number of deals. So you're literally getting more dollars per close because of the stuff that marketing did before these prospects ever came in market.
Right.
You know, the other thing that happens is that the awareness and the education that you can do before someone comes in market is also going to shorten the sales cycle. So again, instead of having the salesperson be responsible for a lot of the product education, which is going to drag out that sales process, if the prospect already has a lot of familiarity and a lot of trust, then there's going to need to be less time in order for them to make a decision. And, you know, you get these, you know, these three key issues: your close rate, your sales cycle, and your pricing power, mm-hmm. that really are almost entirely in the hands of marketing. Sales can do very little about any of these once a customer is in market and is having a conversation with sales. And so marketing has an enormous amount of power, you know, with a fraction of the resources that sales has in order to really make sales both more efficient and more effective. Things close faster, they close at a higher rate, and they close at a higher dollar value because of what marketing did.
I completely agree with all that. And I think that all too often people lose sight of the importance of marketing when, you know, and I also agree with the notion that early stage companies definitely need, the first hire needs to be a salesperson in order to get to the market out, or product out rather. A lot of it, however, boils down to, are you a sales organization? Are you a marketing organization? Or are you a sales and marketing organization? So a lot of that is mindset, right? Where do you feel a successful brand needs to consider all three of those positions when really being, you know, when wanting to ramp up an organization and grow?
Well, I mean, you know, the other question is, are you a revenue organization?
Right. Yeah.
Because if you're a revenue organization, and revenue is important, and quite frankly, with a lot of startups, their behavior indicates that revenue isn't very important, that they're overly obsessed with product, that they are overly obsessed with kind of meaningless growth that isn't necessarily going to be profitable or sustainable. But if you're a revenue organization, the question is, what are the steps you do in order to be able to maximize the amount of revenue you can produce for the amount of dollars you're investing in revenue production,
right,
which is a combination of sales and marketing. And it's got to be a balance. In the same way that you can't have, you know, a marketing team, but no salespeople. And then again, there are a few exceptions like e-commerce companies.
Exactly.
But for most sort of normal B2B businesses, you can't have a marketing team and just think people are going to just buy. But at the same time, you equally well can't have just a sales team without marketing in there doing the stuff to make that sales team efficient. And going back to the thing about startups, my strong recommendation to because again, I come into a lot of startups that are pre-launch and I'm there to help them with the initial product launch. Mm-hmm. And my recommendation is always you need to start active, continuous marketing campaigns a full year before the product launches. Because it's going to take 12 to 18 months of continuous presence in the market before anybody even knows you exist.
Right.
And you don't really need to hire a salesperson until fairly late in that process. You know, and one of the examples I give is if you look at Hollywood and then look at the movie industry, 90% of the marketing budget for movies is spent before anybody can buy the product. Mm-hmm. Because if you didn't, you'd be opening to empty theaters for the first 3 months. And if you're about to launch a product, the same thing is going to happen to you. You're going to be opening to the equivalent of empty theaters for the first 12 to 18 months if you haven't been out there in the market letting people know. And I always tell companies that you know, your biggest problem isn't, do you have the right features in the product? Your biggest problem isn't your competitors. Your biggest problem isn't your pricing. Your biggest problem is that no one knows you exist.
Exactly.
And if you if you can't fix the no one knows you exist problem first, nothing else matters. Everything you do after that, if you haven't fixed that problem, is going to be like trying to push a rope across a table. Yeah. You're going to have lots of effort and just no response.
But let's face facts, Dale. I don't know that I've ever run into a single CEO that is going to agree that a sale can take place 18 months after an investment is made in marketing, especially in a startup environment. And let's not even talk about the mindset of the VCs and the investment community regarding that. That what I feel is a very, very important way to launch a product, you know, in seeding, whether it be through thought leadership, content, PR. I mean, all these sort of things go a long way without creating the need for a quote unquote digital ad campaign before the product launches. I mean, give our listeners today some advice regarding that notion, which again, I believe is very important and worthy.
Well, I mean, I think there are three issues there. One is, I think you need to deliver some very tangible examples. And I just mentioned the one about movies. One of the pushbacks is we can't spend money on marketing because the product isn't available.
Right.
And this is a mindset that needs to be shifted. And the example of how movies spend their marketing money tends to be a very persuasive argument because people viscerally understand from their own experience of going to the movies, that they go to movies because they saw trailers and advertisements for something that wasn't available when they saw the trailer and the advertisement.
Right.
You know, I mean, you look at the recent release of Dune 2. They've been running trailers and advertisements for 6 months.
Right.
Before anybody could see it. And, you know, and as a result, they ended up having a blockbuster opening weekend. So I think pointing to very specific examples in this regard helps and allows people to sort of shift their thinking. The second issue, and this is really, I put heavily on marketers, is this notion that marketing is like flipping a light switch. You know, I flip the light switch, the lights come on instantly. Mm-hmm. And the deal is that that is not how marketing works. Marketing is a very, very slow burn. And I think this notion of all we need to do is to run some Google search ads or something and we'll get instant revenue really is a deep fundamental failure in thinking on the part of marketers that marketing is a very, very slow, subtle, long-term process. And an example is if you look at a company like Coca-Cola, what they're trying to do with their constant always-on marketing is they're trying to shift the average person in the population from having a 1 in 500 chance of buying a Coke this week to having a 1 in 250 chance of buying a Coke this week.
Right.
Now, that's a minor, just minuscule nudge. But if you achieve that, you've doubled your revenue.
And, do you think their marketing is efficient or effective?
I'm sorry?
Do you think their marketing is efficient or effective?
It's effective, for sure. Yeah. I don't even know if it has to be efficient because the product is such a high margin product.
Yeah. And name recognition. But right. It's an interesting battle of the cans because Pepsi and Coca-Cola are constantly battling for 2 to 3 points of market share increase.
Right.
In order to win and create the revenue that they're looking for.
But the reality is that almost everybody that could buy your product will never buy your product.
Right.
You know? Yeah. And so it's not like you need, if your ICP is 100,000 potential buyers, you don't need 100,000 people to write you a check tomorrow. Mm-hmm. You know, if you could, you know, you only need a tiny fraction of that. Yeah. And and what you're looking for is that increment over time of people that are going to consider you versus who would not have considered you otherwise.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this understanding that marketing has a long lag time in terms of having an effect is an important thing to talk to the CEO and the CFO about because, you know, if, you know, the CEO has been busy listening to marketers who, you know, are making the case that it's like throwing a light switch on. As soon as we turn the lights on, you know, as soon as we throw the switch, the lights will be on. And what you need to do is explain, no, it takes weeks and months and quarters for the stuff we do today to start to show, you know, or to fully show a return in terms of sales and revenue, which means that, you know, if you launch the product in July and you want to see some revenue by August or September, we need to have started last year letting people know that it existed, because it's a long, long process. And so it's important to have that conversation about the time lags between what you throw out into the world and the way that people, you know, the amount of time it's going to take before that returns to you in terms of a buying response.
So much of this is reliant upon the plan going to market, the strategy behind it all being very close to as perfect as it can be with, you know, the geographic, the target audience, you know, how you're going to segment that audience, you know, the buyer profiles, you know, what it is that's going to change the mindset of a buyer to choose your product over someone else. And this is a lot of the strategy work that Avocet deploys day in and day out. Where do you see most companies? What's the proof point and really the point of failure where most companies through 18 months of seeding a market for something ultimately end up saying, okay, we didn't have the right audience, or the launch isn't right, the messaging isn't right. I mean, there's so many things that can go wrong without the right strategy up front. And we've done a lot of studying on this. We find that, and it's backed up by tons of studies out there by McKinsey, Deloitte, so on and so forth, that most of these startup companies don't do the research that they need to really understand the buyer so that when they go to market, it can be successful.
Right, exactly. And so the thing that I see over and over again with companies is a complete unwillingness to invest in research, in the early market research in the early days, because they're so convinced that they know who's going to buy the product and why they're going to buy it. And it's not that they don't see research. It's not that they don't know about market research. It's that they think it's a total waste of time, because I already have all the answers. Mm-hmm. I already know all of these things. So why waste the time and money on research? And so, you know, what I will often see with companies is a complete resistance to any kind of market research, because we already know all the answers, a resistance to starting to market before the product's available. You know, so they go to market with essentially a bunch of guesses as to what's the right ICP, what's the right pricing, what's the right positioning, what's the right messaging. You know, and then a year later or a year and a half later, you know, after, you know, having deployed a sales team, you know, they've got very little revenue.
Right.
You know, they're just eking along. And again, it's what I call pushing a rope across a table. That you know, all of this effort on the sales side isn't producing any revenue. And you know, and they often will then,
they're typically going to blame it on marketing though too.
Well, actually, it's interesting what they will often do, and I've been pulled back into companies because I tend to work on what I call commercial strategy, which means it covers marketing, sales, partnerships, distribution, you know, so sort of all of the things related to bringing a product to market.
Right.
And so, you know, I've often been called back into companies a year, year and a half later, and the complaint or the purpose of being called back in is we need to rethink how we're doing sales. You know, we need to hire different salespeople, or we need some sales training, without realizing that the problem isn't sales. That, you know, that's the symptom. The problem is the stuff that you didn't do on the marketing side. And I'll give you a very, very specific example. So a company with and I won't go into too many details, but it's a company in medical clinical diagnostics. They had an absolutely remarkable diagnostic system for, mm-hmm. you know, for early detection of a major form of cancer. And, you know, and the technology was really quite remarkable. very non-invasive, very, very easy for patients to actually do the sample collection at home, send it in, you can get the test done.
Right.
The problem was they were absolutely convinced that a certain medical specialty was going to be the ones who would be ordering this test. And early on, I asked the question, how do you know these are the people that do, that do this sort of diagnostic? Well, we just know. I mean, that this is the area they work in. I said, but do you have any data that shows this? Well, no, we don't need any data. We just know.
Right.
So, we launched the product. They hire a highly, highly experienced salesperson that had worked directly in this area. The salesperson spends a year and manages to sell 10 copies of the test. Not platforms. This is just 10 individual tests. And so we come back in and they finally agreed to what I had suggested in the beginning, which was, let's pull some medical reimbursement data. So you got, so we have these databases that allow us to see, that allow us to see what individual physicians submit for reimbursement in terms of procedure and diagnostic codes. So we pulled data on 40,000 physicians that specialized in this one area for a full year. So all of the procedure and diagnostic codes related to this particular condition. And it turns out that the medical specialty that they were targeting with all of their sales and marketing efforts only diagnosed less than 2% of cases.
Yeah.
That it turns out that most of these early cancer detection cases were being done by primary care physicians and by internists because they were the ones seeing the patients all the time.
Right.
And then the other problem was they were positioning this against an existing test that has been around for quite some time. It turns out that only 0.2% of early diagnoses ever used this particular test they were positioned against. That in most cases, physicians were falling back on much older, much cruder forms of testing that would give them kind of a rough idea. And then they would go straight to do a biopsy.
Mm-hmm.
And what would happen is that your primary care physician would do the initial diagnosis, and then they would just directly refer you to an oncologist. And this other entire specialty was never even involved.
Yeah.
And so everything about everything that they thought was true about the market they were selling into turned out to just be fantasies because they never validated it with data.
Right. And so research is the issue here, the lack of research, but really it boils down to leadership and the mindset that the product is going to sell itself because that leader, whether they be a physicist or a physician, a engineer, name it, who developed the product, who came up with the need, believes that the product is so good that and that they're right, that they don't need the data to ultimately push the product out to market. We've run into that mindset time and time and time and time again regarding this, this position that I know it and we're just going to go for it. We've turned down business in recent years because we vehemently disagree with what the CEO and the C-suite believes the market, adaptability is and not having the data to back it up because
right.
We'll set ourselves up to succeed or to fail in that situation.
Right. And, the going back to the example I was just talking about, once I had the data set in my hands, giant Excel spreadsheet, it took me 48 hours and I had all the answers.
Right.
I mean, this is not a complex, difficult process.
But
get
why?
The data and validate it.
But why not do it? What is the mindset there that says we don't need it?
So I think there are two issues there. One is sort of over arrogance and overconfidence that you know all the answers.
Right.
And again, you see, I think this is much worse in more technical areas. So
I agree.
Things like SaaS, biotech, high tech products, AI products. You have highly technical people that are founding these companies. And And I think in a lot of cases, their confidence in being smart in one area gets falsely transferred into confidence in areas where they're not very smart at all. And so they literally don't know that you know, that these things that they imagine aren't true. And, you know, so again, I mean, this idea of going back and validating these ideas. The other thing is this idea that the product is so amazing that, and I see this over and over again.
I know.
It'll sell itself.
Yeah.
And again, one of the examples I use is, you know, probably the single most anticipated movie release in the last two full years has been the release of Dune 2. Mm-hmm. They spent 6 months of intensive marketing, letting people know what was coming and when it was coming and how to buy it before it ever was available. You know, right. And so, you know, there is no such thing as a product that's so good that it will sell itself. And again, I'll give you a specific example. A client I was working with where they were doing a regional rollout because they had one salesperson that could only cover, and it required a lot of face-to-face selling. So they were actually literally in the field, old school. And so they could only cover a certain region. So they had a very high-value region that they were rolling the product out into. And I was really urging them to, you know, we need to expand the marketing campaigns or at least the Google ad campaign to nationwide. Because again, I was saying it's going to take 12 to 18 months of people seeing this before you're going to start to see a response in the market. You can't wait until you're ready to expand the sales team. And the CEO's response was kind of fascinating. The CEO's response was, well, no, we can't possibly do that. We don't have enough staff. And I said, you know, we've already got the Google ad campaign fully up and going. It doesn't really take any effort to, you know, to go from, you know, a few DMAs to expanding this nationwide. I can do this in 10 minutes. No, you don't understand. We don't have enough people to be answering all of the phone calls and emails that would be coming in.
Yeah.
And I said, that will not be a problem. I can promise you. Nobody,
right.
There will be nobody calling you because it's going to take a long time for this to start to have an effect. But they were so convinced, and again, this goes back to the sort of light switch idea, that the instant we turn the light switch on, you know, the lights will all come on and, you know, and everybody will come out of the woodwork.
What advice do you have for our listeners today on how you can change the mindset of the individual that you just described, that is all about the effect, the outcome of what that could cause versus the approach needed, that seeding approach needed, the breadcrumb approach to really build the awareness so that when you build it, they will, when you are ready, yeah, it will happen. I mean, it's not easy. And a lot of these teams are hiring younger people that aren't as wise as you and I, you know, and who have been in the industry as long as we have.
But I think very, very specific examples. You know, I gave examples
again,
about
yeah,
the movie industry, about Dune 2. Here's another example that's very good, is that, you know, you have to know the market and you have to know the market is ready. And if you look at Apple, who, you know, I think the whole world sees as the pinnacle of marketing success with their products. They do, you know, they tend to do one thing with their product, with their new product introductions, is they're always the last to market and they always thoroughly understand the market. So you look at when the iPhone was introduced, smartphones were already a multi-billion dollar market. You had over a dozen major players, you know, including BlackBerry, who was the 800 pound gorilla that completely dominated this multi-billion dollar market. All this was in place before the iPhone came out. Mm-hmm. And when they released the iPhone, its design was very, very much informed by what they had learned from looking at the successes and the failures of the incumbents that are already in the market. And you saw this with when they released the iPod, the iPhone, the iPad. You know, all of their major product releases have always been tended to be very late to the market. You know, AirPods, all of these.
And look at the impact.
But in their history, they have one massive failure where they didn't do any of those things, where they took a product, They basically didn't really look at any of what the market demand was going to be. They insisted that they were going to literally create demand out of thin air. And this was John Sculley shortly after Steve Jobs was kicked out of the company. John Sculley in the early 90s launched the Apple Newton, which was a handheld computer. They spent $1 billion back when $1 billion was a lot more money than it is now. I mean, this was 30 years ago. They spent $1 billion in 10 years and managed to sell 230,000 units in 10 years.
Right.
And, you know, and it was a complete failure. It ended John Sculley's career at Apple. You know, but it's a classic example of the product. I had the opportunity to actually use one at one time. It was a remarkable product. I mean, it was literally ahead of its time. But that was part of the problem, was it was a product that existed in a vacuum about understanding the market, with this belief that you could force people to buy it. You could force people to want it.
It's all about need.
And the deal is, people didn't want it.
Right.
And what was interesting was, a decade later, BlackBerry introduces the first smartphone. And, and it completely takes off. And it's essentially the core ingredients of what was in the Newton, with the addition of being able, of it being in a phone. But, but the BlackBerry product was, they understood that you need to attach this to a phone, that the market needs to be kind of ready, and again, BlackBerry, understood a lot of this because of what they had done with what were called smart pagers, which was this sort of intermediate step before smartphones. Mm-hmm. And, so again, you have a lot of market research, a lot of understanding about how your product is going to slot into the market and into existing demand. And this understanding that you can't just create demand out of thin air, that Wow. You've got to, you've got to be able to leverage demand that already exists in the market.
Yeah. We have a similar example of a company by the name of E Street Realty that was 10 years in advance of Zillow coming to market, and they didn't have the infrastructure needed to be able to build out the system so that agents would feel that they could utilize it as a tool, as a listing tool, versus just putting up signs and classified ads in areas way ahead of their time. Incredible concept, but it never made it because they didn't soften the market to get it ready in advance.
Right.
It happens constantly. So we've had an incredible conversation today about effectiveness versus efficiency. Any final words of wisdom for our audience today, and how can they get a hold of you?
So two things. One is something that we'd mentioned early on, this idea of ROI, because I think this is an important thing for marketers to understand, because they need to be able to push back on the CFO and the CEO that are demanding proof of ROI. And
right.
This is a lot of why brand marketing has almost completely vanished in the B2B tech industry, is because of this obsession on ROI. And I go back to, you need to give very tangible examples of how to shift, how they need to shift their thinking around these ideas. And so the example I give is, what's the ROI on a factory building? It's not only is it not zero, it's less than zero. Mm-hmm. You have to pay for the entire thing up front, and then you just keep paying forever with maintenance costs, and
Great.
It never produces a dollar.
Right.
So, so it literally has a negative ROI. So why don't we just build all of our factories out in the open in the middle of a field?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is because CFOs aren't idiots, because they know that having that building over the factory is going to make the machines last longer, the workers more productive, the factory is going to be more productive. It's not going to have to shut down every time it rains. Everything that happens in that factory is made both more efficient and more effective by being housed in that building that has a negative ROI. And so, a lot of things like brand marketing, to try to apply an ROI analysis to it makes no more sense there than trying to apply an ROI analysis to the factory building. Mm-hmm. Because if you did that, every factory, I would say, would be built out in the open in the middle of a field and a knot. And so again, you've got to be able to ground these ideas and these ways of thinking in very tangible examples. The other example I give with ROI is if you're the head of marketing for a restaurant, and the question is, what is the highest ROI campaign that you can possibly do? And the answer is, you stand by next to the hostess stand, handing out 50% off coupons to everybody who walks in that already has a reservation.
Mm-hmm.
You've got nearly zero cost per lead. You have 100% conversion rate, and you have thousands of dollars of marketing attributed revenue. It's the perfect campaign. Everybody wins except for the business.
Yeah.
But that is literally the highest ROI marketing campaign you can do. So this is why, and again, this is another very specific example for why we can't think about everything we do in marketing around ROI. And we need to push back on the CFO and the CEO that are demanding, you know, ROI calculations, and give them very concrete examples for why they cannot trust ROI as a metric of effectiveness.
Yeah, so much wisdom, you know, packed into the 40 minutes we've spent today together, Dale. I really appreciate your insights. What is the best way for our audience to get in touch with you?
Probably the best way is LinkedIn. So I'm just Dale W. Harrison on LinkedIn. I'm post regularly, and you know, anybody that's interested can just reach out and, you know, DM me, and you know, if you heard me on this podcast, reference the podcast.
Yeah, I love it. Well, I tell you, thank you very, very much for your appearance today on StrategyCast. So many, many, many nuggets of great, great wisdom for our audience. I think this might be one of those shows that people need to listen to two or three times to really unpack all the goodness associated with it. Dale, we appreciate you so much. Thank you.
Well, it's been fun. Thank you.
Thank you. And for those of you that want to get in contact with me, please go ahead and email me at Lori@StrategyCast.com and sign up for the StrategyCast newsletter as well.
That's a wrap. Thanks for joining us on today's show. We hope your strategic brains are spinning with new ideas and bold inspiration that will elevate your strategies and marketing know-how.